Rosinas on Air, the Criminal Compliance Podcast.
Welcome to a new episode of the Criminal Compliance Podcast. It is my great pleasure to welcome a very special guest to our show today. My name is Miriam Steinfeld, and here with me is Hector Espert from Ecija in Barcelona. Welcome to the show, Hector, and thank you very much for taking the time to joining us today. Before we dive into our topic, would you mind introducing yourself and your practice to our audience?
Yes, of course. Thank you very much, Miriam, for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you. My name is Hector Esbert. I'm a lawyer based in Barcelona and a partner at Ecija, where I focus on complex litigation with a particular emphasis on asset recovery, including fraud cases. A large part of my work involves coordinating cross-border proceedings, tracing and freezing assets in different jurisdictions, and working closely with criminal authorities and private clients to turn victories into actual recoveries. So asset recovery in the broad sense, from traditional fraud to digital assets, it's really at the core of my practice.
That sounds incredibly interesting. So before we get into the specifics of asset recovery, I think it might help our listeners to understand the very basics of Spanish criminal procedure, because as we know, our podcast is hosted here in Germany, and we're used to the inquisitorial model. So how is the criminal procedure structured in Spain?
So the Spanish criminal procedure is historically rooted in the inquisitorial model as well. But over time, it has evolved into a mixed system that combines inquisitorial and adversarial elements. So we still have an investigating judge responsible for leading the pre-trial investigation, ordering measures such as searches, seizures, or freezing orders, and obviously ensuring that fundamental rights are respected. And once the case goes to trial, however, the dynamics become much more adversarial. Prosecution and defense present their evidence in an open court before a different trial court, and the judge, or in some cases a jury, decide the case based on that oral hearing. So in short, investigation is judicially led and written, while the trial phase is concentrated, oral, and completely adversarial.
That is super interesting. So, you know, in Germany, the Staatsanwaltschaft, so the public prosecutor, is clearly the dominant figure when it comes to investigating a crime. So who are the key actors in the Spanish criminal investigation?
Well, so in a Spanish criminal investigation, there are three key public actors. First, you have the investigating judge, who, as I said, directs the investigation and authorizes coercive measures such as searches, interception of communications, or the freezing of assets. Second, the public prosecutor, who promotes the action of criminal justice, requests investigative measures, and ultimately decides whether or not to bring charges against the investigated person. And third, specialized police units, which carry out the practical investigative work under the direction of the judge and the prosecutor. And on top of this, victims and their lawyers can appear as private prosecutors, which is very important in the asset recovery context.
So that is interesting. That seems like a very different model to from what we have here, particularly, as you say, when it comes to asset recovery. So you describe it as a distinctive public-private model. And if I understand correctly, it's particularly effective when it comes to crypto fraud cases. What does it make it different to the other jurisdictions?
So the model applies to all types of cases and not just for crypto cases, even though it has proven particularly useful in those type of scenarios. But what really distinguishes the Spanish model is that victims are by definition are structurally embedded in criminal proceedings from the very beginning and through the figure of the private prosecutor, what we call the acusación particular. The idea is that victims and their counsel, they are not passive observers of the proceedings. They have full legal standing to request investigative measures, present expert evidence, for example, blockchain analytics, and actively push for the freezing and confiscation of assets. So in practice, this creates a genuine public-private partnership, so to speak, where specialized private teams can bring speed, they can bring technical expertise, they can bring international reach to complement the work of judges, prosecutors, and police, especially in complex fraud and crypto cases.
This is really, truly different from our understanding and, in parenthesis, role from victims here in Germany, particularly within the fraud environment, I would like to say, because we do know, obviously, the role of victims being important and getting more important over time. But this is more when it comes to the victim being a physical victim of a crime rather than a financial victim of a crime. So here we see something very different. And I do believe that not just here in Germany, but also in France, for example, you do have the victim participation on paper, yes. But it's not like it would deliver any results comparable to what you have described. So when you look at these systems from what you've seen or what you know, where exactly do you see the bottlenecks there?
Yes. So many European systems, indeed, as you were saying, recognize some form of victim participation on paper. But in practice, that participation is narrow. For example, limited to supporting the prosecution or claiming compensation at the end of the case. So from the outside, you can see several structural bottlenecks. So first, the victim's role is often secondary. Prosecutors retain broad discretion as to whether or not to pursue complex asset-heavy cases. And there are very few procedural tools for victims to drive investigations forward when the system is overloaded. By contrast, the Spanish model allows victims to have their own procedural standing from the very beginning, independent from the standing of their public prosecutor or the police, which gives them more leverage to insist on asset tracing measures and to keep pressure on timing and international cooperation.
That really does seem like it's making a major difference. So we obviously talked about this before, and you told us that there is one case, it's called the Avistar Pyramid Scheme. And to all our listeners, we will obviously put a reference to it in the show notes, where there has been quite a big success for the public-private prosecution with over 2.5 million euros in crypto recovered. So please share some insights on this very special case.
Yes. So the Arbistar case is one of the several cases involving crypto scams that were successful under this public-private cooperation scheme. So this type of cases, what they show is what this model can actually achieve in practice. So as you were saying, in that investigation, more than 2.5 million euros in crypto assets were recovered and secured for victims through coordinated action. Unfortunately, the scam was much larger than 2.5 million euros. At least something was recovered. So what it had in practice is that you had large groups of affected investors. You had a very active private prosecution. You had specialized blockchain forensics, and in particular, last but definitely not least, a judge that was willing to move quickly on freezing orders. And all of this was working together. That's what makes the case special. And that case was followed in front of the Audiencia Nacional, which is probably the most sophisticated Spanish criminal court. But in any case, the private teams, they helped to map wallets, to follow the funds across exchanges and jurisdictions. And then they helped bring that intelligence back into the criminal case so that the court could act on that information while there was still something left to recover.
And this is, I guess, one of the key elements here. You just said it, working well together and being able to move in good time, which is what I would assume is, again, a key element, that it doesn't just come from ad hoc collaboration or goodwill alone, but you do need a very structured framework behind it so that it's clear who can do what, who should do what. Yes. And so how does this cooperation actually practically work?
Yes. So in practice, this cooperation is much more structured than just goodwill. And in larger cases, you will often see joint working arrangements, sometimes even formalized as joint investigation teams, where police, prosecutors, and private experts share information under judicial oversight. You can even see regular case management conferences with the investigating judge, agreed protocols on confidentiality and data protection, and also sequenced for rapid freezing orders. So the goal is to align everyone around one case strategy and one evidence gathering plan instead of running parallel, uncoordinated efforts.
From my point of view, that sounds even more organized and structured than some of the law enforcement agency work within themselves that we've seen. To be quite honest,
yes.
It sounds a bit like the ideal standard how it should be anyhow. But I mean, that is really great to hear. And I think another unique element to the Spanish model is the ARGA. Mm. I don't know if that's the correct abbreviation.
Yes.
So it's the Asset Recovery and Management Office. So mm-hmm. What role does it play in the Spanish model? And is there anything where it's similar to other European models, or what sets it apart from these European models? What is your take here?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, indeed, the ORGA, the Spanish Office for Asset Recovery and Management, definitely plays an important role, unique role, because it combines both the recovery and the management of criminal assets. So the numbers are still low statistically, but they are improving and they are definitely increasing their work. And according to Spanish law, the ORGA can be entrusted by judges or by prosecutors with identifying, tracing, managing, and selling seized assets. And importantly for victims, the ORGA has a clear restitution mandate. It's not just about freezing assets. It's about preserving them. It's about optimizing their value so that after confiscation, there's something meaningful to return to the victims.
Which really does pay again to the whole idea of the asset recovery in combination with the private public mm-hmm. prosecution, because again, mm-hmm. the victims of financial fraud, more than obviously seeing justice being served to any potential mm-hmm. perpetrators, is receiving their funds back or as much as possible.
Yes.
So in this area, again, what we were talking about, the Abista pyramid scheme, from what we've seen here, many of those cases don't just entail one victim, but a large group of victims. And if not just so, maybe even NGOs who act on behalf yes. of some of the victims. So how do they interact with that model?
Yes. So in large scale fraud and crypto cases, victims obviously rarely act alone. They tend to organize themselves in associations or collectives that can pool information and resources. So these victim associations, they often finance forensic work, they coordinate communications, they serve as a bridge between hundreds or even thousands of affected individuals and their legal teams. Running the private prosecution. And on top of that, in Spain, NGOs and other civil society organizations can, in some circumstances, also appear as popular prosecutors, having legal standing in criminal proceedings as well, even if they're not the direct victims of the crime. And understandably, this figure is politically controversial, because it gives private actors a very strong role in criminal proceedings. But I must say it has been instrumental in bringing to light some of the most serious corruption cases in Spain.
So that is, I mean, it is a very, how should I say, unique model, I would like to say. I mean, obviously the idea of having a private public prosecution in and of itself, obviously is a rather new idea. And, you know, I think everybody's at the point to accept that as a concept, but then the popular prosecution again is, you know, putting one on top. But I do think it's something we see coming from the EU. I mean, we in Germany, for example, had it now with GDPR, where victims of GDPR infractions can actually be represented by NGOs. So I do think it's something which is just coming and which is happening. Now, the NGOs, of course, at this point would represent individuals, but you can have corporations both as victims or theoretically as perpetrators of fraud. Mm-hmm. And now here in Germany, we do not have, in a strict sense, a corporate criminal liability. But mm-hmm. this is, as far as I understand, different in Spain, because again, we do not have that genuine criminal liability. So what does the situation look like in Spain on this matter?
Yes. So indeed, unlike some systems that still rely mainly on administrative fines, Spain did introduce true corporate criminal liability into the criminal code in 2010 and significantly strengthened it in 2015. So what this means is that legal entities can be convicted for a wide range of offenses, including fraud, money laundering, where the crime is committed in their name or for their benefit by managers or employees. And very importantly, if there has been a failure of supervision and control, which links this idea to the whole compliance programs. And sanctions for companies can include fines, they can include disqualification from public contracts, they can include judicial intervention, and they can even include the dissolution of the company. So the stakes for companies are very high.
That is very interesting to see, because again, in Germany, we did have some legislative projects in that direction, but they didn't come to fruition. And so I think this is particularly interesting if you look at crypto fraud or money laundering cases. Mm-hmm. So the companies like banks or crypto exchanges can become involuntarily entangled in the crime, just like you said, you know, there, there may be some acting from managers or even completely involuntary as intermediaries or custodians, or simply because the platform was used and then you have illicit funds to surface there. Taking what you shared with us on corporate criminal liability, and we talked about before with the private prosecutors, how does this criminal corporate liability shape the role of these companies in such cases? And does it affect their ability or willingness to step in as a private prosecutor themselves?
So in crypto fraud and money laundering cases, banks and exchanges, they often find themselves in a dual position. On the one hand, they are victims of fraud or deception. And on the other, they are the platform through which illicit funds move. And because they face potential corporate criminal exposure, they have strong incentives to detect suspicious activity, to cooperate fully with investigations, and in some cases, indeed, to appear as private prosecutors themselves to clarify their position and push for recovery. And I must say that Spanish case law has begun to explore this tension, distinguishing situations where the institution has done what could reasonably be expected in terms of compliance from those where structural failures justify corporate liability.
So this brings us straight to compliance, as you just said, or the lack thereof. In Spain, we have the Modelo de Organización y Gestión, and that has become a cornerstone of corporate defense. So how do Spanish corporates actually handle compliance in practice? And is there a real legislative or factual incentive to be a good corporate citizen?
Absolutely. In Spain, corporate compliance programs are not just a nice to have. It is expressly recognized as a potential exonerating or mitigating factor under the Spanish Criminal Code. So if a company can show that it had an effective compliance system in place before the offense, with risk mapping, with controls, with training, and with independent monitoring, this can exclude corporate liability or reduce the penalty. And beyond the criminal code, there are, of course, strong reputational, regulatory, and even civil law incentives for companies to demonstrate that they are good corporate citizens, especially in sectors like finance and crypto, where trust is fragile.
I think it's fragile is a very nice way of putting it. So we talked about corporate criminal liability, private public prosecution, compliance. So if you put all three together in my world, what comes next should be internal investigations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now this, from our perspective, from a German perspective, internal investigation is always very interesting. We do not have that genuine criminal corporate liability. We do have the necessity of management to look into situations at some point, or there can be a necessity. So for me, when a company first detects suspicious activities in its systems, what role do internal investigations play before the matter ever reaches the criminal courts? And how do internal investigations feed into the said and explained later private prosecution?
Mm-hmm. So yes, when a company detects suspicious activity, internal investigations are the first line of response. They're supposed to be the first line of response. So they allow the company to clarify what happened, to preserve digital evidence and evidence in general, to interview relevant staff, to take the urgent remedial steps, including stopping the ongoing misconduct. And under Spanish law, the findings of an internal investigation can later be shared with prosecutors and courts. And if properly structured, they can be used both to support a private prosecution or to demonstrate that the company is serious about compliance. So again, those two roles that we were discussing earlier. So there is obviously an important balance between maintaining legal privilege and cooperating with authorities. But when done well, internal investigations become a central pillar of the public-private enforcement model, of course.
It does seem so. And it really shows nicely how both the corporates within the compliance and liability framework before, during, and after have mm-hmm. this dual position and the dual interest in serving these. So we talked a lot about the private-public prosecution, but clearly I would assume that there are other avenues one could explore if one is trying to recover some assets. Could you give us a brief overview?
Yes. So beyond the criminal track, Spanish law offers several additional avenues for asset recovery. First, within the criminal proceedings themselves, victims can claim compensation through civil actions so that the same criminal judgment will address both criminal responsibility and civil damages. That's also an interesting element of Spanish law. Second, third parties who claim ownership of seized assets, they can also protect their rights, which is relevant when assets are in the name of intermediaries or relatives. And outside the criminal case, victims can obviously still resort to pure civil or commercial litigation or even insolvency proceedings when that's useful.
So how do you, or how would you combine those tools in practice?
Mm-hmm. So in practice, in complex cases, practitioners will need to build a toolbox strategy rather than relying on a single path. So a typical sequence might be you have an urgent criminal complaint to secure freezing orders. You have parallel civil or insolvency actions to reach assets or information that lie outside the criminal case. And then coordinated use of the ORGA and international cooperation to manage and recover the proceeds. So the key is timing, the key is coordination, and making sure that criminal, civil, and insolvency tools support each other instead of creating conflicts or duplication.
I think that would be in everybody's interest if the proceedings are actually harmonized and organized as
Definitely.
A whole. I think that's one of the big challenges. So talking about big challenges, you have laid out such a really good sounding system that you're experiencing in Spain. And clearly you made some experiences there that we haven't, at least for sure, not in Germany. What are the biggest challenges? Or in other words, what are the lessons that you've learned so far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one big challenge is aligning priorities and time horizons of public authorities and victims, because prosecutors and judges, they must think in terms of legality. They must think in terms of fairness for all parties, while victims, they focus on speed. They focus on recovery. So that's number one. Number two, you have international coordination, which is another pain point. You have cross-border cases, which depend on quick cooperation with foreign authorities and private actors, like exchanges in crypto scams. And delays can mean that assets disappear or they lose value. So international cooperation is a great, great challenge. And then also volatility, custody risks. They're not just technical issues, and they affect what recovery means when the asset itself fluctuates widely in price. That's another issue.
That can be a really big issue. That is true. We have had that here too. So what is then still like the limit? You just mentioned the time issue or the cross-border issue. Mm-hmm. Where would you say, okay, this is really where the corporation does hit a wall or a limit?
Yeah, well, we've seen in decentralized finance protocols, privacy coins and mixers or platforms that operate entirely from third country jurisdictions or especially offshore jurisdictions, they can make effective tracing and freezing extremely difficult. And another limit is, I would say, technical capacity, because both public authorities and private practitioners, they need constant investment in training, in tools, in specialist staff to keep up with innovation, especially in the crypto space.
That is true. It's a race in which you have to keep investing. From all your experiences that you've drew, and building on those lessons you just mentioned, perhaps looking at the fact that we're all within the EU and clearly we do have very different legislation, at least in our both countries, and mm-hmm. we all know there are more. So if there's one message you could send to the European legislators on this issue and to your colleagues across the EU as well, perhaps, what changes would you like to see or hope to see in the next few years to bring this kind of public-private cooperation to truly mm-hmm. European level?
Yes. So if I could send one message to European legislators, I would say take seriously the idea of embedding victims structurally into criminal proceedings and not just as an afterthought. Our model was created in the 19th century. Our code of criminal proceedings dates 1882. So that's when we started. And for us, the role of victims and private prosecution in criminal proceedings is at the core of what criminal proceedings mean. Then obviously, a real European framework that facilitates public-private partnerships, supports specialized asset recovery offices like ORGA in every member state, and streamlines cross-border freezing and restitution could make a real difference in practice. And we do have European regulations that cover criminal cooperation also in terms of asset recovery purposes, but we know that in practice, those instruments still are not used to their full extent, if you will. So, and to colleagues across the EU, I would say build bridges with prosecutors, with police, with victim associations and technical experts, because in asset recovery, no single actor can succeed alone. So it's a team effort.
And don't forget to build the bridges to other colleagues across the EU, right?
Of course.
Well, thank you so much, Hector, for being with us on our podcast this time and your very insightful and interesting explanations of the system in Spain. And also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to contact us at any time at info@rosinus-on-air.com. See you next time.
Rosinus on Air, the Criminal Compliance Podcast. The podcast only provides a general overview of legal issues and, of course, does not replace legal advice on specific issues in individual cases. If you have any questions, please contact a trusted lawyer or, of course, feel free to get in touch with us. www.rosinusonair.com or at www.rosinuspartner.com.